Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Speaking today with Gus DeZeriga. Gus is a professor in the Department of Politics at Whitman College in Walla Walla, Washington. He's an artist, and he's the author of two very interesting books, Pagans and Christians, A Personal Spiritual Experience, and Persuasion, Power, and Polity, A Theory of Democratic Self-Organization. Welcome, Gus.
Thank you.
The reason that your book originally came to my attention was because I've been involved in polemics as a progressive lefty kind of person. I've been involved in polemics around the question of libertarianism. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's always struck me about the libertarian folks that I debate against is this notion that the market, in their estimation, the market is a self-organized structure, whereas everything that human beings do, all kinds of governance that human beings do, is supposedly this imposition on nature. And from my view, the market is as much a human creation, a product of human planning and creation, culture, as governance. And governance is as much organically evolved as the market. And that seemed to be something that was coming out of your book. Is that a fair estimation of one of the insights of your book?
Well, it's sort of. Let me rephrase it. That while the market is indeed a self-organizing system, it makes possible the creation of enormous hierarchical organizations, corporations in particular, and these are certainly not self-organizing systems. And the same essentially holds for a democracy, that is, that the rules of the game of a democratic polity are capable of generating and do generate a self-organizing process in which nobody is really in charge. However, within that game, the players, as in a market with corporations, will try to get as much power as possible. And so in both cases, there's substantial inequalities in influence between the different players. But the game as a whole is not really controlled by anybody, if that clarifies the point.
Well, if you look at organic systems, there are hierarchical phenomena within organic systems. There mm-hmm. there are bodies that have control, central nervous systems and meta controllers of genetic code and so forth. So there is organically evolved hierarchy in nature. Not all of nature is single-celled organisms competing against each other.
Right. And the difficulty of thinking about hierarchy and self-organization is that both are found, and yet they're different. For example, there was a recent book titled Emergence, The Connected Lives of Ants, Brains, Cities, and Software by Stephen Johnson. And he points out, the work of a scientist and philosopher whom I've always admired a great deal, Evelyn Fox Killer, her work with slime molds. And slime molds are a very bizarre kind of organism in which, under good circumstances, they're a bunch of free-living amoeba. When the environment becomes more challenging, they come together to form a single organism that crawls along a forest floor and eventually sends up a spore packet that disperses future slime molds. And what's interesting about it is here are individual organisms, each in a sense having their own hierarchical set of conditions they need to meet to survive, but largely through chemical signals, change their way of behaving in order to manifest something much different, which is itself does not come together in any hierarchical fashion, and yet manifests as a single organism. So hierarchy and self-organization are both found, as in nature, in markets, in democracies, in lots of different contexts, but they need to be kept separate or we get confused, because a hierarchy could be thought of as pursuing a goal or ranked order of goals, whereas self-organization does not.
So just as a multicellular organism can be the product of self-organization, like a human body, mm-hmm. a corporation or a nation state could be the product of evolved patterns, but it no longer has the features and you would argue, I think, the beneficial features of self-organization because it has become institutionalized.
Well, but it can do as an organism as well. They can do things that a self-organizing process cannot do. So they're, so long as, I guess my basic point would be, so long as they do not exercise too much control within a system in order to distort its feedback processes, that organisms or corporations or political parties or interest groups can perform a very positive function. But because their sort of institutional interest is to grow and find stability, there's a tension between them and the system in which they exist, such that they will attempt, if possible, either deliberately through, say, a corporation seeking monopoly power, or not necessarily deliberately, but through their own genetic programming, overpopulation of an ecosystem by a particular organism, they will act in a way that, that in the long run can undermine the order that sustains them.
Now, is this what you would refer to as evolutionary liberal theory, the theory that you've articulated in some of your articles?
Well, in a way, evolutionary liberalism is a very complex philosophy, and there are basically three strains to it: the rights-based liberalism, a utilitarian liberalism, and then that growing out of the Scottish Enlightenment, which is really neither, and has a emphasizes how customs and points of view and all arise out of the workings of a society in an evolutionary way. Hume was perhaps the most important. That kind of liberal perspective helped to shape biological thought. Theory of evolution itself has its roots in this kind of work and in the Scottish Enlightenment. So, yes, this evolutionary model is in harmony with evolutionary liberalism, but the way I was describing it to you just now was much broader because it included biological evolution, which is certainly not liberalism. Liberalism doesn't apply to an ecosystem, but rather to certain types of human institutions.
You reference Hayek, and apparently you're quite popular with Hayek. You're listed in some of the Hayek websites. And what I struggle to understand is your argument seems to be pretty much diametrically opposed to the Hayekian argument that I articulated at the beginning, the idea that all governance would be an imposition on the self-organization and information system of the market.
You're completely correct. My status with a lot of Hayekians is very ambiguous because on the one hand, I see my work as building on insights that he made better than anybody else I've encountered. On the other hand, I think those insights do not necessarily carry over to a sort of libertarian marketolatry perspective, and that Hayek himself identified, even at the social level, at least two other self-organizing systems, and that is three, actually: science, common law, and language. And that got me to thinking, well, if they all are self-organizing, then while they have a systemic similarity, there must be obvious differences, because science does not equal the market, does not equal common law. And in the course of puzzling over that, I realized that liberal democracies meet the same kinds of standards, but they're oriented towards a very different set of values than the market. And at that point, there was for me a conceptual shift in which I realized that the standard libertarian market-oriented view of the matter was simply completely false, even from within the intellectual context of some of the more sophisticated theorists that they cite, like Hayek. Hayek himself, though, was not really a libertarian, and endorsed a number of political policies that people would call incredibly liberal in the modern sense of the term.
You seem to argue that if a polity tries to accomplish equality, if a polity tries to make its citizens equal, mm-hmm. then it becomes an instrumental imposition of the kind that you don't consider to be a self-organizing system, and you seem to find that problematic.
Yes, and again, yes and no. I'm sorry to sound weaselly. If that grew out of a critique of the work of Robert Dahl on the nature of democracy, if you define democracy as absolute equality among all citizens, you end up with a lot of paradoxes, because the concept doesn't really make sense. And if you say a decision is only democratic if it promotes this ultimate goal, then you have superseded a particular goal, whatever it might be, with the concept of self-governance by citizens, where political discussion and debate, ideally with relative equality between the different partners, leads a society to be self-governing. And just to illustrate the point, after 9/11, once again, what the goal that American society had was not greater equality. The goal was we will all stand together against the terrorist threat. And to illustrate the kind of tension that exists there, as soon as a democratic society has a common goal that everybody feels, or most everybody feels, it's at that time that it often acts the most undemocratically, such as more controls on freedom of speech, setting aside habeas corpus, and things of this sort, where John Ashcroft can say, anybody who disagrees with me gives aid and comfort to the enemy, which is the constitutional definition of treason. This kind of thing can happen because a non-threatened democracy doesn't really have a common goal. But certainly, and I would personally endorse political measures to substantially increase the degree of equality in American society. I think it's gotten seriously out of whack.
I'm speaking with Gus DeZeriga. He's the author of Pagans and Christians and Persuasion, Power, and Polity. He's a professor of politics at Whitman College in Washington. You have at the end of your book a kind of utopian vision of what a self-organizing democracy would look like. Mm-hmm. And to me, it closely resembles anarcho-syndicalism, the idea of a federation of municipal citizens cooperatives. Do you take any particular inspiration, or do you see yourself as distinct from anarcho-syndicalist traditions?
Well, in the 60s, I was very drawn to a number of anarchist theorists. Kropotkin was actually my favorite, and as well as to the more anarchist side of some libertarian thinking. And in a way, this is a coming together of both. That is that the problem with the anarcho-syndicalists is that if you didn't have a price system to sort of provide signals to hold complicated economic relationships together, there was no way to really have a particularly well-integrated order beyond the size of a very small town. And yet, if you had a price system without any kind of appropriate political systems, you were open to the kind of abuses that our system has of over-centralization of power and dependence on money for influence. And so, yes, there's definitely a connection. I, however, am skeptical that one can go all of the way.
You think there needs to be a market mechanism?
I think there's no question that there needs to be a market mechanism. And the trick is what kinds of institutions can be designed or can arise that can make use of the information that a price system generates, but not become dominated by that value and that information the way a public corporation in particular becomes dominated. Cooperatives, for example, are just such an institution.
Back in the early 90s, I edited a publication, a zine, called Eco-Socialist Review. Mm-hmm. And one of our bête noirs, one of the people that we argued most vociferously against, were the deep ecologists. And because of their agreeing partly with Murray Bookchin's critiques of them for their lack of social justice concerns and their misanthropy. You seem to consider yourself a deep ecologist, but a lot of your writing doesn't fit, in my mind, with deep ecology. Do you consider yourself a deep ecologist because
yes.
you see this is it because you see a continuity between this argument about the evolved nature of institutions and nature itself? In which case, why aren't you a social ecologist as opposed to a deep ecologist?
Boy, talk about a complicated question.
Yeah.
First of all, Bookchin creates a straw man in his image of deep ecologists. This notion of misanthropy is, in the overwhelming percent of cases, silly. And even in the cases of people like Dave Foreman, who occasionally will say something like that, it's more, I think, for shock effect than because Foreman believes it. But let's go to the dominant American intellectual force in what we might call ecocentric thought, and that's Aldo Leopold. Leopold, who virtually every deep ecologist holds in virtual veneration in a lot of ways, writer of the San Conde Almanac, one of the most profound books on an ecological sensitivity ever written, in my judgment. In there, Leopold has a very interesting statement about human beings, and I think it lays to rest this whole misanthropic interpretation of deep ecology, and that is that he says something to the effect that if passenger pigeons had been around when the last person died, no pigeon would have particularly noticed or cared. However, when the last passenger pigeon died, a great many people noticed and cared. And then Leopold says, and this is from memory, but it's pretty close, here is something new under the sun, a species that cares for the well-being of others of no particular, you know, utility to it. And so to the misanthropic argument, I would say, in fact, the deep ecology care and concern about nature for its own sake is a sign of the most advanced and uniquely human capacities. And people who emphasize that nature should be appreciated primarily because of its utility, however broadly you want to define that, to human beings, probably exhibit a level of awareness more like a raven than of the highest human capacity. So I would turn that argument completely on its head, say Murray Bookchin has a long way to go to demonstrate the full capacity of human awareness to encompass in a compassionate and caring way all of the universe.
Well, let me give you a hypothetical. You have three people in a room, and they're offered the choice of saving humanity or saving the ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And the first person is your typical unenlightened person, and they say, no problem, humanity, save humanity. Mm-hmm. The second person says, I value the ecosystem over humanity. Humanity's been a cancer on the planet. I'm going to zap humanity. And the third person says, I deeply value nature, and it greatly pains me to do so. But in the end, I have to choose humanity, even though I'm going to sit here and weep for days and days. You're saying that the second person, the one who zaps humanity, is not the real deep ecologist. It's the third person who's the real deep ecologist. But there are actually people out there who argue that humanity is a cancer on the face of the planet.
Oh, yeah.
And what are those people if they're not deep ecologists?
I think that kind of choice is the kind of choice the Nazis gave to a Greek woman once when she could pick which of her sons they would execute. And perhaps I'm not even sure what it means to say save humanity and sacrifice the ecosystem. I see the two as integrally connected. So in a way, I would say it's the kind of choice that, you know, well, which of the two people you love most will you sacrifice for the other, when in fact each is what it is in part because of its relationships with the other. So I can't even imagine a situation like that. It's a extraordinarily artificial case. What would it take for humanity to survive if there were no ecosystem? I don't know that humanity could survive without an ecosystem. An ecosystem could survive without humanity, but its highest potentials in compassion, in caring, certainly would not be in existence again for a very long time to come, for millions of years. So it's a kind of tragic choice where, in all honesty, I don't know how I would decide. And the reason I don't know how I would decide is you're talking about the person saying, okay, here's your mother and your father. We're going to kill one. You get to choose.
Yeah, but the equal value on the ecosystem and on humanity still seems to me to reflect this fundamental problem that, for me, as a humanist, just as Aldo said, you know, that humans are the ones who value nature. Nature doesn't value humans. So all sorts of value has to come from human neurological complexity, or I personally expand it to the neurological complexity of other species, but humans being the most pertinent example. And so, you know, if there is no other neurological complexity out there, then there is no value. So all value has to come from human beings in that view.
That's one interpretation of reality, a materialist interpretation that I think is wrong. I think for a variety of reasons that we are not valuing creatures set down within a universe that is value-free except for whatever we perceive and impose upon it. And indeed, to take a simple example of... And it's just a simple example of what is an incredibly, as I know you know, complicated issue. The you are driving along on a foggy day, and all of a in an area that you don't have not been to before, and all of a sudden the fog clears, and there is this extraordinary sight of say the California coast at Big Sur, or the Colorado Rockies on Trail Ridge Road, or some such thing, and you're taken aback at just how incredibly beautiful it is. I think if somebody said, "Oh, well, what you did is you just imposed value on that scene," somebody would you would say, "I think you missed the point. I didn't impose it. I perceived it. It was there, and it caught me by surprise and left me in amazement and joy," or something of that sort. That so it's I would deny that the universe, nature, however you want to call it, is a simple a sort of a template on which human beings paint their capacities, be they good or bad.
I'm speaking with Gus DeZeriga. He's a professor of politics at Whitman College in Walla Walla, Washington, and author of Persuasion, Power, and Polity, Theory of Democratic Self-Organization. He's also author of Pagans and Christians, and I want to turn the discussion a little bit to that, because that's another very intriguing aspect of your personal biography.
Yeah, and that's where we're headed on your last question.
Well, exactly. I presume that the deep ecology and the questions about the valuation of nature and the reverence for nature is one of the things that you take from Wicca and supports your Wicca beliefs. Can you tell us a little bit about, you're a Gardnerian Wiccan, and you're also involved, I see, with the coven of Unitarian Universalist Pagans. I'm a Unitarian myself. So how long have you been a pagan, and did the politics come first or the paganism come first?
Well, I had, to finance my dissertation at Berkeley, I had become an artist and sold my pen and ink art in printed form in various venues, including at fairs and as a street vendor at Berkeley. Well, you encounter people in that context that you never encounter in graduate school. And one of them claimed to be a magician. And at one point, I dared him to show me some real magic, mostly because I wanted to see how he would get out of it. And he took me up on that, and basically my pretty Western worldview was shattered one evening on the Berkeley campus. And at that point, for a couple of years, I was in a bit of a crisis because I just completed my PhD. I'd been planning to go into a very traditional academic career route, and then all of a sudden, what appeared to me, the basic presuppositions of that worldview had been experientially proven to me to be false. It was then that I started studying with a Wiccan teacher and various people trained in more shamanic kinds of practices, and over the years began to regain a sort of equilibrium of being able to do both traditional scholarship and this kind of work. And what I found is that all my life I'd had a deep love of nature, but my view had been very similar to the one that I was just critiquing in our last question, that nature is incredibly beautiful, but it's there's really nothing there. It's what we bring to it. And I discovered quite powerfully that was, to my own satisfaction, not true. And that led to, in a way, my sort of academic project these years, and for the rest of my life probably, which is trying somehow to harmonize, if it can be done, the fruits of modernity, which are very sweet, with the kind of appreciation of being immersed in a deeper community of value and consciousness that many of what we might call primal peoples knew to be true, that Taoists, even some Buddhists certainly would say the same. How to bring those two kinds of awareness into harmony again.
As a pagan anarcho-syndicalist, I assume that you, like myself, have been attracted to green politics. Have you dabbled in the local greens? Are the greens palatable to your taste?
Well, I'm not really an anarcho-syndicalist. Let me phrase that. I have sympathy for that position, but I don't go all the way with them. But having said that, I find myself with very mixed feelings about the greens, because in certain areas they seem to be I'm talking now about the American Greens, quite serious about what they're doing and doing some good work. On the other hand, sometimes they appear to be more interested in playing the role of spoilers, because they claim there's no difference in the two parties, anyone who can claim that today, after the last year, I think has been indulging into some pretty serious drugs.
Some of them have.
Yeah, and drugs that destroy their capacity for very, very insightful political analysis or much of anything else. The point is, under our system, under the electoral rules that currently exist, if you vote for a third party, most of the time you may as well vote for the main party that you like the least. And that's one of the major problems right now with the American political system. There's, in the West anyway, where we have the initiative. A very simple solution to that, which would be initiatives asking that majority rule be used to elect any official rather than plurality rule. And what that means is that if no candidate gets a majority, then there's a runoff between the top vote-getters. It goes on in France that way. It provides an environment where third parties can be effective, where you, by voting for them you don't undermine your own values, and where perhaps on occasion they can even become one of the main parties. Greens have yet to push for such an obvious reform. Until they do, and I'm told now that in the Bay Area of San Francisco Bay Area they are. Well, it's about time. Until the Greens start actually showing the political maturity of seeing what they're up against and the very simple and probably quite popular methods to mitigate that problem, then I have to say, on the one hand, I'm very sympathetic to them. On the other hand, I'm also very ambivalent towards them because I see them as not being serious but more playing the politics of personal self-righteousness. I'm more pure than you because I don't compromise. And that is to miss the whole point of what it's like to live in a community where people don't agree.
Gus, it's been really fascinating talking to you. And I do recommend for those who have the disciplined mind. I have your book is your PhD thesis, right? And so
it was developed quite a bit after that.
Yeah, for those who have a serious interest in political theory, this book really does illuminate a lot of these questions that we've been talking about. And the book I'm talking about is Persuasion, Power, and Polity: A Theory of Democratic Self-Organization. I've been speaking with Gus Dizerega. And if you do a search on Gus's name, you'll find your website, which has a lot of your articles over the last 20 years that you've written there about ecology and paganism and politics. Is anything forthcoming that we should know about?
Working on a very interesting project, if it hangs together, on in the 20s and 30s, there was a debate between Marxists and market advocates over whether central planning could replace a price system. Very, very interesting debate. And it was really an example of the Enlightenment ideal of rational control versus uncontrolled systems. In retrospect, I think it's fairly clear that the central planners lost both theoretically and practically. I think the same position holds for attempts by corporations and governments to control and rationally plan the complex system of nature. And it'll be up on the site. Those will be up on the sites fairly within the year.
Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Dr. J.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.